From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with mystery writer Lawrence Block about creating his Matthew Scudder Private Eye series and about his early crime novels from the 60s, which are being republished. Block's 13th Matthew Scudder novel, Even the Wicked, has just been published. Also, actor Tim Roth. He was in Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. Now he's starring with the late Tupac Shakur in Gridlocked, and he's singing in Woody Allen's new film, Everyone Says I Love You. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Spice, the debut album by the British group The Spice Girls. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with crime writer Lawrence Block, who many mystery readers consider one of the best in the field. His crime novels of the 60s are being republished by Carolyn Graff. His new novel, Even the Wicked, is the 13th book in his series about Private Eye Matthew Scudder, who lives and works in New York. Scudder's life has changed since the series began in the mid-70s. He started as a heavy drinker. About halfway through the series, he joined AA. In the early books, he was a loner. Now he's married to a former prostitute named Elaine, who recently used her savings to open a Manhattan gallery. I spoke to Block in 1995, after the publication of his Scudder novel, A Long Line of Dead Men. We started with a short reading from that book, which will give you a sense of Scudder and his relationship with Elaine.
When we met, I was a cop with a brand new gold shield in my pocket and a wife and two sons in Syosset. And she was a young call girl, bright and funny and beautiful. We made each other happy for a few years, and then I drank my way out of my marriage in the police department, and we pretty much lost track of each other. She went on doing what she'd been doing, saving her money and investing in real estate, keeping fit at the health club, stretching her mind in night school. A couple of years ago, circumstances threw us together again, and what we'd had was still there, stronger than ever and richer for the years we'd lived through. At first, she went on seeing clients, and we both pretended that was okay. But of course, it wasn't. And eventually, I bit the bullet and said so, and she admitted she'd already put herself out of business. We kept inching closer and closer to marriage. Last April, she'd sold her old place on East 50th and picked out an apartment in the Park Vendome, and we'd moved in together. It was her money that bought the place, and I'd refused to let her put my name on the deed. I paid the monthly maintenance on the apartment and picked up the checks when we went out to dinner. She covered the household expenses. Eventually, we would put all our money together, but we hadn't gotten around to that yet. Eventually, we would get married, too, and I wasn't sure why it was taking us so long. We kept not setting a date. We kept letting it slide.
I read your books in part for the atmosphere. The mood of the character, the mood of the situations you've created. I mean, Scudder is somebody who wants something he can't have, alcohol. He deals both with the meaning and the meaninglessness of life. He's very good at what he does, but he has very little to show for it in terms of financial reward or material gain. And that doesn't often bother him, but it sometimes does. And he's a guy who stands back from the world and looks at it and tries to figure it out. This is an atmosphere that I find very appealing. What kind of atmosphere do you want to create? What kind of mood do you want your Scudder books to have?
I don't know exactly. I suppose in a certain way I write the books to find out. I'll start out with a plot idea, and I don't really know what state of mind of Scudder's is going to be reflected. I don't know what the moods are going to be. That develops very much as the book goes along.
The mood of some of the Scudder books were so dependent on his drinking and then later on his not drinking yet wanting to, and his loneliness. And now I think he's got his drinking pretty well in check. I mean, yeah, he still wants a drink and he still goes to AA meetings, but it doesn't constantly gnaw at him in the same way that it did. And he's got his loneliness in check. I mean, he's in it for the long haul with Elaine. So are you having to find other things for him to deal with?
There's always the danger in a series, if you let it evolve organically, that eventually you're going to write yourself out of a job.
Right.
And I thought that it happened with 8 Million Ways to Die when he stopped drinking. I thought that exhausted the character as a character. And it did for a couple of years. I was a little while between books there. And then I discovered that for Scudder, as well as for people in the real world, there is life after sobriety. And I think there's also a similar danger now, in that he is in a stable relationship, and he seems to have, if not solved, then outlasted most of the major problems in his life. So that is part of the challenge, is to find a way that he can still be involved in a compelling story, even given this change in his circumstances.
Why did you put him in a long-term relationship with Elaine, a former prostitute?
Well, it just sort of grew. I didn't have the intention of that either. You know, Elaine is in the books from the very first one. She appears in The Sins of the Fathers and just in a cameo appearance. And then in the 8th book, A Ticket to the Boneyard, that's when they get back together again. And I just really liked the way they were together in that book. And I don't know. It seemed right. I couldn't break them up after that.
The first books you wrote under pen names.
Yes.
Why were they pen names?
Well, the books were trash.
What was trash about them?
Just about everything. I'm sustained, Terry, by the knowledge that these books were not printed on acid-free paper.
How many years has it been? They probably still exist, right?
they probably do. People bring them up to me at signings expecting me to sign them. I say, sign it, I won't touch it. You know, get away from me.
So you knew then that you didn't like what you were writing, but it was good experience and you can make a book?
It was good experience. It was a good paid apprenticeship.
And these were what, crime novels?
No. These were, I guess now you would call them softcore porn.
How'd you break into that market?
It's hard to remember. Actually, it shouldn't be hard to remember because I am writing a memoir about those days. But it was, my agent suggested that I try one for that market. I had an agent at that point, and I did. The market was just beginning to exist, so I was one of the first people doing it. This was in, like, the late 50s.
What were the boundaries that you had to write within? What would have been going too far?
Well, you couldn't use four-letter words.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't be terribly graphic.
And did there have to be a sturdy plot to rest the sex scenes on so it would look like a real novel?
No, there had to be the illusion of a plot, but there had to be a lot of incident. And it was wonderful training ground because you could. It was an extremely forgiving medium, as you can imagine, because as long as it was sufficiently erotic and the story kept moving, it didn't really matter if there were vast holes in the plot or anything of the sort. So I learned a lot doing it.
I imagine this helped you write with inhibition also. I mean, without inhibition, because you weren't using your name. So you could try anything without people.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Holding you accountable.
Very, very true.
I think that's a hard thing for young writers. You're so self-conscious that this isn't good enough and so-and-so isn't going to like this and what if this gets a bad review?
That's right. That's right. I hadn't even particularly thought of that, but it was very liberating in that respect.
Was it liberating, too, to be writing sexual scenes?
I think so. You know, I was like 20 years old at the time. So it was science fiction in a sense for me.
Now, did the covers have illustrations that gave the promise of more than you were going to actually deliver?
Oh, no, I delivered. I delivered. Nobody ever brought the book back for a refund.
My guest is Lawrence Block. His new Matthew Scudder private eye novel is called Even the Wicked. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is mystery writer Lawrence Block. His crime fiction from the 60s is being republished. Here's a reading from one of those early novels. It's called After the First Death. It begins with a man waking up naked on a bed in a strange room. He has no idea how he's gotten there. Maybe he's coming out of a drunken stupor. Maybe it's something worse. All that he's sure of is he's in pain and he's in trouble.
I sat up on the bed and looked around. I started to get up. And there was something on the floor, something sticky that my feet touched. Wet and sticky. I closed my eyes. A shiver went through me, a chill caused by more than the cold and my own nakedness. I kept my eyes closed and folded my arms foolishly across my chest. I did not want to look. I did not want to know. I wanted to go to sleep and stay asleep for ages and wake up elsewhere, miles and years away. I wondered, briefly, if it was a dream. I opened my eyes again. I picked up one foot and looked hopelessly at the bottom of it. Blood. I tried to catch my breath and somehow couldn't, and I looked at the floor, and the nausea came back again in a flood with no warning. I threw up with the spontaneity of the knee-jerk reflex. It was that automatic. I looked, I saw, I vomited. I thought of the way I had reached across the floor as if it were a sea in which I dared not set foot. An apt image. The floor was a sea of blood. A body floated upon this ocean. A girl, black hair, staring blue eyes, bloodless lips. Naked. Dead. Her throat slashed deeply. It had to be a dream. It had to be a dream. It was not a dream. It was not a dream at all. I've done it again, I thought. Sweet Jesus, I've done it again.
What is he afraid he's done again?
Killed a woman in a drunken blackout.
Take us back to 1969. Do you remember writing this book and how you came up with the story and what you were going for?
Yes. Let me see. I think I wrote the book in 67, I think. I got the idea of a person who had managed to get himself out of prison on the strength of one of the recent Supreme Court rulings on inadmissibility of confessions or something like that. And I thought that it would be interesting if such a person found himself committing the same crime again, but became aware of that he hadn't really done it, that he'd been framed this time. And then, of course, presumes that perhaps he was framed the first time, too, and thus has a great incentive, on the one hand, to avoid capture, and on the other, to solve the crime.
It seems to me you must have been living in two really different worlds, you know, the world that you lived in, and then the world that you wrote about, a world in which people are framed all the time, and people are murdered all the time, and you know, that crime world of fiction that so many, you know, movies and novels and TV shows are set in.
Right. Well, that's not difficult to enter, simply exploiting one's own innate paranoia. But in this particular book, I was quite familiar with the Times Square scene that I've described here. That was something I knew well at the time.
Why did you know it well?
Oh, because I hung out there a lot.
Uh-huh. What brought you there?
Oh, personal yearnings. Corrupt motives?
Okay. Do you care to elaborate, or do you want to leave it at that?
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Now, how did you start the Matthew Scudder Private Eye series, after writing a lot of books that weren't part of a series in which there were no recurring characters?
Sure. I just, the Scudder series, unlike some other series that I've found myself doing, was conceived as a series. I set out to write a group of books about this character, and I had the character figured out and the publisher in line for this before I wrote the first book. So it was conceived as a series. What was not conceived was the idea that Scudder would change from one book to another.
Why did you make him an alcoholic?
Oh, he was just that from the beginning. I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. When I talk about the way the series changes, I say sometimes that, in 8 Million Ways to Die, he surprised me by getting sober, and that actually I had no idea he had a problem.
Is that true?
No, I knew he had a problem. That was part of it, that he was, a heavy alcoholic drinker from the early books on, that and the angst-ridden and guilt-ridden nature of the man.
Is Matthew Scudder's drinking based on first-hand experience that you had of drinking?
Well, Scudder and I were different kinds of drinkers, I think, in certain respects. But without getting into this too much, I can say that he and I both used to drink, and neither of us does now.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something I've been trying to figure out about you.
Okay.
Okay. the mood in the Scudder books, which I so like, is so... It's often so kind of, gloomy. And I mean, there's a murder that he's trying to solve and a drink that he wants to have and he can't. And, there's all these, like, yearnings that are going to go unsatisfied in one way or another. And I get your newsletter. You actually have your own newsletter that updates your readers about, your latest books and where you're going to give a reading and stuff. Your newsletter is so upbeat. It's kind of like, dear readers, feeling great.
Well, you wouldn't want to get a newsletter from Scudder, for God's sake.
Well, I probably would, but I'm trying to figure out, now, how is Lawrence Block so kind of like feeling good and upbeat and able to write, this real downbeat kind of series? Like, where do those two connect,
There's one's... me and the other's the character, I suppose.
But you created the character. I mean, he came from you.
True. True. There was a wonderful story told about Morris Karnofsky, the actor in the Yiddish theater, who auditioned for a Shakespearean role. And he came on, and he talked and introduced himself and everything with a thick accent. And they were giggling hysterically at the thought of him auditioning for Shakespeare, and then they said, "All right, well, do the scene, Mr. Karnofsky." And he said, "Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the son of York," and a flawless reading, and they were stunned, and they weren't familiar with his work, and they said, "How, Mr. Karnofsky, there's something we have to ask you. It seems so remarkable." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Oh," he said, you mean the accent?" He said, "He said, I'm an actor. I'm an actor." And I love that story. And I think that applies here. The books are darker than I am. I'm a writer.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, this was a treat.
Lawrence Block, recorded in 1995. His new Matthew Scudder Private Eye novel is called Even the Wicked. Gerald Marks, who wrote the song All of Me, died earlier this week at the age of 96. Marks also wrote the song Is It True What They Say About Dixie? All of Me has been recorded by zillions of jazz instrumentalists and singers. One of my personal favorites is this version, recorded by Billie Holiday in 1941 with Lester Young.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use them. Your goodbye left me with eyes that cry. How can I go on, dear, without you? You took the part that once was my heart, so why not take all of me?
All of Me, music by Gerald Marx, who died Monday at the age of 96. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Tim Roth. He co-stars with the late Tupac Shakur in the film Gridlocked, and Roth sings in Woody Allen's new film Everyone Says I Love You. Roth played Mr. Orange in Reservoir Dogs. In Pulp Fiction, he held up a restaurant only to get outdone by one of the diners who happened to be a hitman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I love you, Pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
That's my guest Tim Roth holding up a coffee shop in Pulp Fiction. It was his second film with Quentin Tarantino. In Reservoir Dogs, Roth was the cop who goes undercover on a bungled heist and gets shot. Roth doesn't just specialize in contemporary mayhem. He played Vincent van Gogh in Robert Altman's Vincent and Theo, and he co-starred with Gary Oldman in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. He put on a powdered wig and showed off his swordsmanship in the historical romantic adventure Rob Roy. Now he sings in Woody Allen's new film, Everyone Says I Love You, in which he plays a gangster just out of prison. And he's starring with Tupac Shakur in the new comedy Gridlocked, which was completed shortly before Shakur was shot and killed. In Gridlocked, Shakur and Roth play musicians who have decided to kick their heroin habits. They want to get into rehab, but they can't cut through all the bureaucratic requirements. To make matters worse, a couple of gangsters are on their tails, and the character Roth plays has been wounded in a shootout. That gives Shakur's character an idea.
Stab me.
Get the f*** out of here. I ain't gonna f***ing stab you.
Look, if we're in the emergency room, we're off the f***ing streets. Once we get in the hospital, we can kick, Stretch. What the hell are you tripping off? I'm the one that's gonna be cut. Besides, it's a pocket knife.
I don't feel comfortable with that.
Come on, Stretch. We can't be out here all night. You're bleeding all over the place. You gotta go anyway.
Where?
Where what?
Where you want me to stab you?
Oh, what do you think is best?
Well, if I stab you in the stomach, I might hit some organs and
yeah, you're right. About the stomach.
What about the arm?
Nah, too wimpy.
Well, if you turn around, I could stab you in the back.
Nah, you're f***ing paralyzing me. Not the back. Okay. My liver's on the left. Stomach's on the... No, my liver's on the left. My kidney's back here, and my stomach's on the right. No, my stomach's on the... Or is it my kidneys on the left?
I think the stomach's the left.
Well, I know my lungs are right here, and I definitely don't want to punch your lung.
What about if I stab you between the organs? You know, like maybe between where the stomach and the kidneys meet.
A scene from the new movie Gridlocked. I spoke with Tim Roth in the spring of 1995 and asked him how he first met Quentin Tarantino.
Well, it's the same thing, you know, your agent sends you a script, you read it, and with that one, I was reaching for the phone, you know, after the second page, because I thought it was hilarious and, you know, beautiful dialogue. I love the dialogue with Reservoir Dogs. So, I went and met him, and then, you know, it was an audition process and trying to get the job.
Harvey Keitel was probably already a part of the project when you signed on, because I think he was even one of the producers or backers or something. But I know he was in on it from early on. Did you want to work with him? Were you already an admirer of his?
I've always been a fan. I think he's one of the great actors, American actors. And I had grown up on films like Fingers and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and, you know, these films and The Duelists. So, I was a big, big fan. I was very nervous to meet him.
What was your first meeting with him like?
Well, he was trying to get me to read, and I was refusing to read.
Why didn't you want to read for the part?
I get really embarrassed by reading. I'm very bad at it.
You get embarrassed by it?
Yeah, I get really... I'm very, very bad at the auditioning process. And the way I look at it is that that I will lose as many jobs by reading as I will by not reading. So... it's a 50-50 thing, and I decided not to do it. But eventually, Quentin, you know, we went out and got drunk, and Quentin got me to read every character in the script, but that was at a later date. But first meeting with Harvey was that he was saying, look, I really want you to read, and just to get an idea, it doesn't have to be a great audition, blah, blah, blah. But I refused to do it at that point. So that was my first meeting with him. So not only was I in awe of him, but I was turning down one of his requests.
So you read every character in the script. How did you end up being Mr. Orange?
That was the one that I wanted to do. Quentin had thought of me for Pink or Blonde, and at that stage, in the early stages. But I liked the idea of lying. Not only was I an Englishman playing an American, but in the film I was somebody pretending to be something else. And
right, because in the film you're an undercover cop who's pretending to actually be a criminal, you know, who's in on the heist. And even, like, as you die through the movie, you have to remain in character as a gangster and not a cop. And there's this great scene early on, right after your shot. Harvey Keitel is driving you to the hideout, and you're kind of bleeding to death in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And you're whimpering, going, "I'm dying, I'm dying." And Keitel is trying to reassure you and trying to get you to get a hold of yourself.
I'm going to die! I'm going to die! I'm going to die, I know it!
Oh, excuse me, I didn't realize you had a degree in medicine. Are you a doctor? Are you a doctor? Answer me, please. Are you a doctor?
Huh? No, I'm not.
Okay. So you admit you don't know what you're talking about. So, if you're through giving me your amateur opinion, slide back and listen to the news. I'm taking you back to the rendezvous. Joe's going to get you a doctor. The doctor's going to fix you up. And you're going to be okay. Now say it. You're going to be okay. You're gonna be okay. Say the damn words. You're gonna be okay.
Oh God!
Say the damn words. Say it.
I'm okay, Larry.
Your voice is great in this scene. It's this falsetto.
Yeah.
Tell me about hitting the right voice for this.
Well, with that sequence, Harvey really likes to rehearse everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so does Quentin, for that matter. I really don't like rehearsal for film. But so that was the only scene that I insisted that we didn't rehearse, because I actually didn't know what I was going to do. And so what you see there is what we did when the camera first started rolling, and it was just what came out of my mouth. I had no idea what to do. And it just, that was spontaneous.
Was Reservoir Dogs the first film that you played with an American accent?
No, I'd done a film called Jumpin' at the Boneyard up in New York, which came and went, unfortunately. It's a good film about two kids in the Bronx up there.
Do you have any reservations about doing an American accent? Were you confident that you could do it?
Well, it's just a lot of homework to try and do it accurately and not slip across the water. You know, it's a lot of homework to do. On top of trying to build a character, you have to hide behind a voice in a way, and it can get in the way. Initially it always does. In the first 2 weeks of filming, it can be, you're more self-conscious than you should be, and then you start to forget about it, you know. But it's a long process. I work with a dialect coach. The woman actually that I killed in Reservoir Dogs is my dialect coach.
Oh, that's funny.
I wanted to kill her, so I got her the job.
Well, where did she start with you?
We start 3 weeks beforehand with she breaks the script down into syllables, into just sounds, and then we work over and over and over again just on those lists, and then you start working from the script, doing the scenes, and then she's on set every day when I'm filming, every night or day, whatever. And then we also work in the looping, so revoicing the film afterwards, so if there's any mistakes, you can cover your tracks there.
Now, in Pulp Fiction, you were cast as the small-time crook, the wannabe, mm-hmm. who holds up the diner, only to find out in the last scene that some of the customers are professional hitmen, as played by John Travolta and Samuel Jackson. Now, did you choose that role, or were you just... Is that the role that you were offered?
No, Quentin wrote it for me. He wrote it for me and Amanda to play.
Uh-huh.
And I'd introduced him to Amanda at a premiere of one of her films, Fisher King. And I said, I want to work with her. I just finished a student film with her. And I said, I want to work with her in one of your films, but she has to have a big gun. He said, okay. And he went off and wrote it, and that's what he came up with.
So you've had to learn how to use a gun well and badly for films that you've been in. How do you learn how to use it for a film?
Well, I tend to not like penis extension gun movies. So I like to look for a way to use it which is not overtly macho, unless that's the character, which can be also fun to play with. But I don't know, you see too many guns in movies nowadays, especially after Quentin. I mean, the scripts that I'm getting now are very sort of, you know, five guys sitting in a cafe where they're wearing black suits and they're discussing Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, it can get a little tedious after a while. I think they should bring back sword movies, drive-by swordings.
Well, they just did, I understand. I know, you're in it, right.
But drive-by sword play, you can't do it. They should bring back swords. Ban guns, bring back swords.
My guest is Tim Roth. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Tim Roth. How did you start acting?
I auditioned for a school play as a joke, and it backfired, and I got the part, so I had to do it. And once I'd stepped out on stage, I just thought, this is the greatest thing to do. This is such fun.
So what was the part you got?
I got to play Dracula in a musical of Dracula. So it's something me and Gary Oldman have in common.
Yes, that's right. Of course, in Coppola's Dracula. Yeah. So you had to sing too, huh?
I had to sing, dance, you know.
Singing and dancing Dracula. What kind of Dracula songs did you have?
I can't remember. It was so silly. It's one of those school plays that you do, which has a large cast, so a lot of kids can get involved in it, and it was fun. It was really good fun.
So you liked it? You liked being on stage?
Yeah, it terrified me at the beginning, I really liked it. I loved it. It's purely selfish. It's not for any of sort of isn't it wonderful to entertain people reasons. It is good for me. I like doing it. It makes me feel good, you know.
Did you start pursuing acting after that?
Yeah, immediately. I went to art school in the meantime because I already had a place in art school and I was studied sculpture. But I quit that pretty quickly. I was always off anyway, doing a play here or there. So I immediately started to pursue. I didn't want to stop from then on, and it's been the same ever since, really.
So what movies did you love when you were growing up?
I think I was really influenced by early American movies. Not early American, 70s American movies. And also Kubrick and Truffaut, I suppose.
When you say 70s movies, with Scorsese's
early stuff.
And, Coppola.
And French Connection, films like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, those kinds of things where they were. I mean, Scarecrow is a great movie. I always loved Scarecrow with Hackman and Pacino, and Dog Day Afternoon, things like that. Wonderful.
So, when you were in England admiring all these American films starring great American character actors, did you see yourself ever taking the kind of role that American character actors got?
No, I never did. It just seemed so far away to come to America. I'd never been out of the country, you know. To come to America and be in movies was just, you know, a pipe dream. It just seemed the impossible thing to do. And then as I started to work in England more and get some notoriety, I suppose, Gary Oldman took off. He went off and did a film called State of Grace up in New York and played an American and did it very successfully. And I thought, well, it is quite possible, really. I mean, if you can take the plunge, if you get invited out there to do a film, that's when it's possible, you know. So you, and I always thought, don't ever go until you're invited, otherwise you'll just end up being a bartender. You know?
So did you wait until you were invited?
Yeah, I got lucky. I got to go to New York and make that film.
State of Grace?
Mm-mm.
Which film?
Jumping at the Boneyard. The one I was
Jumping
about.
At the Boneyard. Oh.
It came and went so quickly it created a vacuum. but it was a great, you know, sort of realism piece and I got to play somebody from the Bronx. I got to sort of test the waters. And then I thought, well, I'll go to LA and do a bunch of meetings before I go back to London. And I stayed. I thought, well, I go back to London, go back to unemployment. What's the point? So I stayed and got Reservoir Dogs.
Oh.
It was a weird circle.
Uh-huh. So you really weren't too well established at the time of Reservoir Dogs.
Only at home, not here. I mean, hardly anyone saw Vincent and Theo. You know, nobody saw Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There'd been a bunch of television films that I'd done at home. I'd worked with Mike Lee, I'd worked with Stephen Frears, I'd worked with quite a few people, but nothing that had been really seen out here. So apart from by filmmakers had seen my stuff. So that was where I had at least a foot in the door somehow.
Did you study acting?
I never did, no. I just went for it. As soon as I knew that I wanted to do it, I didn't want to stop doing it. I wanted to go out on stage and do it immediately, as opposed to go to school and study it and then go out on stage. You know, I think if I'd have gone to school, I wouldn't have been an actor, actually.
Why?
I was the same when I was at school, in normal school. As soon as I was told to do something, I didn't want to do it. As soon as I had to do homework, I didn't want to do it. It's only now that I can do homework because I choose to. And I think if I'd have gone to drama school and they said, okay, tomorrow we're going to start working on Shakespeare, I would have been bored.
So
it's a question of, I guess, rebelling against it, even if it's in your best interest. You know?
So when you were in school, did you have trouble in school?
I was the bullied. I was the one that was pursued. And basically I hid for about 5 years until it was all over, until all the bullies left.
So how do you think of yourself as dividing your time between more commercial films and more eccentric independent films?
Well, I used to be an independent film snob, you know, up until quite recently, up until I got paid. And what happens is that, first of all, you can pay the rent. You're not worrying about that, which is a major preoccupation. And then if you do something in the studios, it doesn't really matter if it fails or not. If you're in a studio film, it's easier to persuade the financiers, the people that are loath to part with their money for an independent film. It's easier to persuade them to do that. You know, they say, well, he was in a studio film. You know, maybe it'll create some interest is created out there for him, and we'll give you a few grand. You know, plus if you can find a good studio film to do, there's nothing wrong with it. But I used to be such a snob, and I think that there's a danger in that.
Being
elitist, I only work in the independent field. You know, everything else is rubbish. Well, look at what Harvey's done. Harvey has managed to walk that fine line between doing very commercial projects and being able to afford to have a family or whatever, and do things that he is completely passionate about that without his name or would never get made. You know, he can do Sister Act, and then he can do Bad Lieutenant.
Did you feel like you learned anything that you could use yourself by watching Harvey Keitel perform?
He gets very, very he gets very deeply involved in his characters. He takes everything very personally, and I really do think that he takes it home with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned that is not a way that I want to go. I love what he does, but I don't think I could live like that. I really don't. I mean, you do take some of it home with you, I suppose it's by nature, that's what you do. It's the nature of the job. But I couldn't do it all that way. I couldn't. I'd go mad. I'd drive everybody mad around me, too.
So say on Reservoir Dogs, when he was one of the gangsters, what would he take home with him?
Well, I think, the very, very end of the film, when we shot that last scene...
Mm-hmm. You're both bleeding to death and dying.
Very, very in there. I don't know what he was using to get what means he was using to get in there, but it was actually quite scary that how complete he was as the character.
Well, how could you tell that he had done something extreme inside himself?
Well, he'd be weeping for 4 hours after this. We finished the scene. You know, I think that's taking it. Well, that's the thing about the method, is that everybody has their own and that's his. You know, that's how he gets there. I hope that I'll never have to go to that extent to get there. I don't think my personality could deal with it. I don't think my life could deal with it.
No, so like if he'd be weeping after the scene, would you stay away from him, give him
privacy?
No,
I'd be with him. I'd be with him and we'd talk and stuff. And, it's the way it is. You do what you do. You do what you need to do to get in there. And it's pretty amazing.
Tim Roth recorded in 1995. You can see him in the new comedy Gridlocked. Roth is also in Woody Allen's new film Everyone Says I Love You, in which he plays a gangster just out of prison. He sings this song to the character played by Drew Barrymore.
I could show the world how to smile. I could be glad all of the while. I could change the gray skies to blue if I had you. I could leave the old days behind, leave all my pals, I'd never mind. I could start my life all anew if I had you. I could climb the snow-capped mountains, sail the mighty ocean wide. I could cross the burning desert if I had you by my side. I could be a king near uncrowned, humble or poor, rich or renowned. There is nothing I couldn't do if I had you.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by a group that's already a big hit in England. This is Fresh Air. The Spice Girls are a group consisting of five British vocalists whose first single, Wannabe, is a number one hit in England and 22 other countries. They're the latest teeny bopper sensation overseas, and rock critic Ken Tucker says that their inevitable American invasion is actually something to look forward to.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want.
That's Wannabe, the Spice Girls' first single and the lead-off cut on the British quintet's debut album called Spice. Wannabe is one of those hits that's utterly unstoppable. Perky yet tough, catchy yet melodically surprising. The song is a canny mixture of dance, funk, and girl group liberationism in the manner of the Supremes and the Marvelettes. The song defines the essence of Spice Girldom with its list of what it'll take, quote, if you want to be my lover. You gotta give, and You Gotta Make It Last Forever are among the salient requirements. The Spice Girls' follow-up single is Say You'll Be There, another example of fluff with weight, featuring a musical quotation from George Clinton's P-Funk in its pace and vocal style.
You gotta take it easy, throw it far too much.
It's always a dicey business, this stardom in the genre that's come to be called Britpop. Sometimes it translates into stateside success, as in the case of Oasis, and sometimes it doesn't. Does the name Kylie Minogue mean anything to you? How about the group called Take That? Well, they were household stuff in England. But early indications are that the Spice Girls could hit it big here. Wannabe premiered on the Billboard chart at number 11 with a bullet. What lifts the Spice Girls above the status of female Bay City Rollers is the fact that Spice is a devilishly good collection of pop songs. The girls deploy their thin, snarky voices in the service of white hip-hop that's not without soul. Say You'll Be There is the Spice Girls' bid for street credibility, but it's the fearlessly corny ballad Mama that'll probably keep them from being one-hit wonders in America. She used to be The Spice Girls push a teasing sexiness. The video for Wannabe shows them in tight mini togs, prancing around London, crashing stuffy parties and making white-haired old men smile. One British teen magazine referred to the group as Oasis with a Wonder Bra. Over there, they like their pop acts silly and over the top. In America, we always make our teen idols feel guilty as if they should be doing something more serious, which is why no one here wants to be the next Menudo. Given the saucy pleasure to be taken from the Spice Girls, I think we'd do well to lighten up and just let pop stars be pop stars.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Spice, the debut album from the Spice Girls. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.